Welcome to the Daily Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It's Wednesday, April 8th, and this is our Macro Geopolitics AI Blockchain Edition. I'm Maya.
And I'm Alex. Today feels pivotal, doesn't it? Like observing a grand cathedral being built, so many interconnected forces, each archway crucial to the overall structure, and a wrong stone could compromise everything.
Pivotal is right. Let's start with geopolitics. Oil prices are doing what exactly? We'll unpack the latest flashpoints in Ukraine and what that fragile world order really means for energy markets.
And then we're diving into the AI enterprise race. Everyone's talking scale, but are they prioritizing security enough? It's a huge question.
Huge is an understatement. And speaking of huge questions, Alex, you wouldn't believe the macroeconomic warning signs we've flagged. Deglobalization isn't just a theory anymore, it's happening, and the stagflationary pressures are real.
Real enough to make even the most optimistic forecasters pause. But don't think it's all doom and gloom. We're also tracking crypto's evolution. Institutional flows are changing the game, but with that comes new risks.
Risks that we'll dissect, because as we always say, knowing the pitfalls is half the battle. Let's get into it. So over 800 ships are currently trapped in the Persian Gulf. That feels significant. Let's unpack the geopolitical risks swirling around oil Ukraine and what everyone is politely calling a fragile world order.
It absolutely is significant, Maya. That number represents a very real choke on global trade, and the swiftness with which things escalated and then de-escalated seemingly highlights the underlying instability. We're looking at a situation where even a temporary ceasefire, like the two-week agreement between the US, Iran, and Israel, is built on incredibly shaky ground.
Shaky ground being attacks continuing despite the agreement. Daniel Biman pointed that out, and it feels like a critical detail that's getting lost in the oil prices down headlines.
Two things stand out. The 16% drop in Brent crude, as Jason Schenker cautioned, isn't a sign of genuine stability. It's almost entirely driven by a reduction in risk premium, fear of infrastructure attacks, not a substantial increase in actual oil supply. The logistical challenges of reopening the Strait of Hormuz, as James Wilcox stressed, are enormous. We're not talking about a simple unlocking of a gate.
It's not like flipping a switch, is it? Coordination with the Iranian military, establishing payment conditions, it sounds like negotiating with a very motivated and potentially unpredictable partner.
So here's the picture. That's before we factor in the broader strategic calculations at play. Dalia Fahmy's question about whether the war served U.S. strategic interests is crucial. Is this about oil, or is Israel positioning itself within this peace process? The ambiguity is unsettling.
Unsettling is a good word. And then you've got Trump's threats, which, as Daniel Biman pointed out with that fantastic TACO acronym, threats, announcement, compliance, off-ramp, seem more about perception than actual results.
That's a brilliant distillation of Trump's approach. It suggests the ceasefire could have been reached weeks earlier, and the brinkmanship was largely performative, designed to create the illusion of decisive action. It's about claiming credit, even if the underlying progress was inevitable.
So a lot of posturing for the win.
It appears so, at least on the U.S. side. But the discrepancy between Pakistan's claim of a ceasefire covering Lebanon and Netanyahu's denial is particularly worrying. Iran is attempting to define the truce as a regional de-escalation, while Israel is trying to limit it to a bilateral issue.
Which means potential for immediate unraveling if Iran starts interpreting the terms differently.
It's a fundamental fault line in the agreement's enforcement. And it reinforces the idea that this isn't a unified solution, but a patchwork agreement with limited scope.
Okay, let's talk Hungary. Because it keeps coming up. Russia's supplying 90% of Hungary's gas and oil, that's a lot.
It's a near-total dependence, and Putin's public support for Orbán's government is a clear indication of overlapping interests. And the $90 billion in EU loans currently blocked by Hungary, adding pressure on Ukraine, it's a complex web.
So Orbán needs the EU money, but he's beholden to Putin. That's a tight spot.
A very tight spot.
JD?
Vance's accusations of EU election interference, unsubstantiated as Piotr Skolimowski deems them, serve a strategic purpose for Orbán. It allows him to portray himself as a defender of national sovereignty against external pressure.
Translation, don't blame me for the economic mess, blame Brussels. Classic move.
The pattern is clear, that aligns with the interests of the Trump administration and potentially Putin. The convergence of these powers around Orbán's continued rule is a rare geopolitical dynamic.
Rare being concerning.
Highly concerning. It implies the election's outcome will have implications beyond Hungary's borders, particularly regarding EU support for Ukraine. A weakened EU, hampered by internal divisions, is a strategic win for Russia.
And let's not forget about Ukraine's economy, $90 billion in EU loans frozen because of Hungary. That's a pretty significant lifeline being cut off.
It is.
And the fact that Trump and Putin's interests seem to coalesce around Orbán's continued rule means they're likely actively working to undermine EU unity and support for Ukraine.
We're seeing a kind of strategic leverage through economic pressure. It's really interesting.
It is.
It's a modern form of geopolitical maneuvering, and it's incredibly effective. Bruce Richter's framing of flip-side dynamics, dislocation leading to opportunity, applies perfectly here. Volatility creates conditions for specialized investment strategies to thrive, but it also creates opportunities for destabilization.
Meaning while everyone is panicking about Ukraine, someone is quietly making a fortune off the chaos.
Potentially. Private credit markets, as Moody's revision to negative suggests, are particularly vulnerable. But also potentially profitable for those who understand the risks.
So let's zoom back to the oil for a second. You mentioned the logistical challenges of the Strait of Hormuz. What does that actually look like?
We're talking about over 800 ships needing coordination, Iranian oversight, establishing secure passage routes. It's an incredibly complex undertaking. And it's not just about getting the ships moving, it's about ensuring their safety.
Safety being avoiding another attack.
Worth noting the fact that Trump can now claim that it was his threats that led the Iranians to the negotiating table, as Daniel Byman noted, is a revealing observation about the signaling function of strong rhetoric, even in the absence of conclusive causal evidence.
The threat itself might be more important than the actual follow-through.
It appears so, at least in this instance. But consider this, the actual physical flow of oil from the Strait of Hormuz remains uncertain despite the ceasefire. The current price drop is likely driven by a reduction in risk premium, not a substantial increase in supply.
So we're pricing in relief, not reality.
Stepping back, which makes it incredibly precarious. A minor disruption could quickly reverse the gains.
Let's bring Turkey into this, because they're selling or loaning around $20 billion worth of gold to stabilize its lira. What does that have to do with any of this?
It signals a broader trend of central banks adjusting their holdings in response to global energy shocks. It reverses a previous trend where central banks were driving gold prices upward, with the change signaling a focus on currency stabilization and fiscal needs. The shift from accumulating to selling gold hints at heightened financial stress.
Because gold is the safe haven asset, right? So everyone rushing out of it is not a good sign.
It's a telling detail. It foreshadows continued downward pressure on gold prices as more nations follow suit. The entire geopolitical landscape is rippling through financial markets. Think of these trade routes as intricate silk roads, and a disturbance in one part of the network, a blocked passage, a change in currency, creates reverberations throughout the system.
That's a vivid image. And a scary one. Okay, one last thought on Hungary. Trump's overt support for Orbán despite the underlying economic vulnerabilities. Why?
It's a strategic calculation. Trump needs a win in Europe, and Orbán represents a relatively easy target. But the economic vulnerabilities, despite Trump's support, pose a significant threat to his re-election. Orbán's self-deprecating comparison to a mouse aiding a lion reveals a rare alignment of powers, with potentially destabilizing consequences for Ukraine and EU funding.
Trump is willing to prop up a potentially unstable ally to achieve short-term political gains.
It appears so. And the convergence of interests between Russia and the U.S. in supporting Orbán is a non-obvious and strategically concerning development.
So where does this all leave us? 2 weeks. A fragile ceasefire. Unpredictable actors. And a whole lot of ships stuck in the Persian Gulf.
It leaves us in a state of profound uncertainty. The long-term stability of the ceasefire is incredibly uncertain, with significant differences remaining between the U.S. and Iran. We've seen time and again that a temporary agreement is not a guarantee of lasting peace. The underlying tensions, the strategic calculations, the domestic pressures, they all remain. Frankly, I don't know how this plays out. And the fact that a major geopolitical crisis like this is so heavily dependent on the whims of a single individual, President Trump, is in itself a source of immense risk. That's the truly unsettling part.
I'd agree. And that lack of predictability is what should keep everyone up at night. Because even a small disruption could quickly spiral out of control. That's what makes this so uniquely dangerous. And with all of that volatility, it begs the question, how are organizations preparing for a disruption to supply chains and critical infrastructure? That's a conversation we need to have next, because the intersection of geopolitical flashpoints and AI-driven security threats is becoming increasingly acute. Last year, the narrative around AI was almost entirely hype, potential singularity, job apocalypse, endless innovation. Now, it's about vulnerabilities, compute costs, and who can actually afford to build anything useful. We're talking about the AI enterprise race.
The data tells a story. The shift is more dramatic than just tempering expectations. It's fundamentally restructuring the competitive landscape. Anthropic's growth, a 9,700% annualized rate, isn't just impressive, it suggests a fundamental reassessment of market dynamics. It's not about the coolest tech anymore, but about scalable business models.
Scalable and apparently about not wasting money on video. OpenAI's Sora pivot feels desperate.
It does. Their expectation of $30 billion in model training costs this year, triple last year's expenditure, is a clear indicator they're pursuing a very different path than Anthropic. That divergence in cost structure points to architectural choices and a rapidly escalating financial arms race. It's worth noting Anthropic deliberately avoided video, focusing on enterprise solutions like cloud code.
Anthropic bet on boring and OpenAI bet on a very expensive special effect.
A simplified view, but not inaccurate. The data shows Anthropic's focus on agentic AI tools for businesses, like cloud code, contributed to its competitive advantage. OpenAI is now scrambling to catch up, specifically in agentic coding tools, illustrating the shift in strategic priorities. A year ago, they were pursuing distinct markets. Now it's a direct fight for the same core enterprise customer base.
And enterprise customers are shockingly spending money. Anthropic doubled its customer base with over $1 million annual spend in just 2 months.
That is the key signal. The surge in enterprise spend highlights a viable revenue model. It's not about convincing millions to subscribe to a chatbot. It's about securing a relatively small number of large contracts. That creates predictable revenue, which is obviously far more attractive to investors ahead of a potential IPO.
Predictable revenue or a desperate scramble to justify valuations. It feels like OpenAI's $122 billion funding round is starting to look a little precarious.
It's both, realistically. The fact that Google and Broadcom are committing multi-billion dollar chip deals to Anthropic is arguably more significant for them than for Anthropic. It establishes a new business line for Google's TPU sales and guarantees demand for Broadcom. It's a strategic play for hardware dominance disguised as an AI investment.
So Anthropic's success is kind of benefiting everyone else more.
To a degree, yes. But that also speaks to Anthropic's positioning. They're not just building models, they're fostering an ecosystem. Cloud code in particular has been well received by software engineers, creating a stickiness that's hard to replicate.
Speaking of stickiness, let's talk about security. Project Glasswing or Capybara Mythos sounds concerning.
Concerning is an understatement. Anthropic identified thousands of zero-day vulnerabilities, some dating back 10 to 20 years during internal testing. The delay in public release to allow for remediation is a direct acknowledgement of the immense power and associated risk. The model is so capable it poses an immediate global security threat.
An existential crisis for code. That's a marketing slogan I didn't expect.
It's internal terminology but accurate. Their strategy isn't simply to release the most powerful AI model, but to proactively mitigate these vulnerabilities through partnerships and testing. The $100 million pledged to companies like Microsoft to test and repair open source software is a massive undertaking, directly addressing the weaknesses they've identified.
Weaknesses they accidentally revealed with a source code leak. Cloud Code version 2.188 exposed 2,000 files and over 500,000 lines of code.
A setback certainly, but also a demonstration of the model's capabilities. The incident underscores the potential for misuse and the company's shift towards enterprise clients, those willing to pay for advanced AI features and security assurances. Over 1,000 customers now spending over $1 million annually validates that model.
They're deliberately courting power users, essentially selling a very powerful, very dangerous tool to people who can afford to manage the risk.
That's a fair assessment. Their revenue growth exceeding $30 billion in Q2 2026 isn't just a market expansion story, it's intrinsically linked to these vulnerabilities. They're both creating a significant security problem and positioning themselves as the only viable solution.
It's like selling fire extinguishers after accidentally setting half the forest on fire.
A darkly apt analogy. And the leaked memo referencing the model as potentially destructive speaks to a strategic awareness of the weaponization risk. The willingness to share the model with government partners, despite ongoing legal disputes, further illustrates the perceived gravity of the situation.
Right, because open sourcing this thing feels irresponsible.
They acknowledge that competitors will replicate the technology, shifting their focus to proactively securing the existing code base. That sets a precedent for collaborative AI safety in a world of open source competition.
The Acmin-UMG deal feels almost unrelated, but the rapid enterprise acquisition, 1,000 clients paying over $1 million for coding agents, demonstrates a novel strategy.
It's not unrelated. It reinforces the point about sticky revenue. Targeting a specific use case coding creates dependable contracts, contrasting with OpenAI's broader consumer focus. That's a headwind for NVIDIA and OpenAI, both of whom rely on broader market adoption.
And that adoption is facing a fundamental shift in cost dynamics, right? Balaji Srinivasan's point about AI recreating the Chinese internet ecosystem.
The low cost of data copying drives a need for digital autarky within trusted groups. Companies are rebuilding infrastructure, prioritizing internal coding, and a lack of trust in external services. That's not a bug, it's a feature.
So less collaboration, more walled gardens.
The cost of verification is skyrocketing, compressing the cycle from decades to months. That forces a fragmentation into trusted groups capable of leveraging AI internally while erecting barriers to external access.
But isn't that bad for scale?
It is, but it also creates value. Srinivasan predicts a shift towards personal, private, programmable AI. That's where the differentiation lies, not in the models themselves, but in the ability to customize and control them. And as he points out, the value of AI output is inversely proportional to its generic quality.
A slide deck readily identifiable as AI-generated evokes distrust. Lazy, stupid, or evil.
That's his phrasing, but accurate. It sets the stage for a backlash of AI teetotalers who avoid AI altogether. The crucial distinction is that visual AI, image and video verification, is immediately useful because humans have innate GPU-like processing for detecting anomalies. Verbal text remains far more challenging.
So no public undisclosed AI. Got it.
Correct.
An AI's alignment is currently built to start when you prompt it, which is economically useful but has different implications depending on the domain. The digital realm has a fuzzier boundary of tasks than the physical world.
And that brings us back to the body as a continuous source of telemetry, right? Mike Snyder's integrome concept.
We can trace that further, AI preemptively prompting actions without requiring verbal input. The body as a data stream informing AI interventions. But the core point remains, AI is becoming a massive distributed workforce needing direction.
A billion factory robots and digital agents outsource tasks, but crucially still requiring human articulation of desired outcomes.
And that's where the train test paradigm breaks down. Markets and politics are non-time invariant and adversarial, unlike static datasets. Attempts to apply AI directly to these areas will be self-defeating.
A polytheistic model of decentralized AIs, with China constraining autonomy through cryptographic keys.
Correct.
Preventing self-replication. A practical braking mechanism against a Terminator scenario. The value proposition shifts from doing to sensing. Humans become the sensors defining needs and prompts, while AI acts as the actuator. That moves the competitive advantage away from access to the AI tools themselves.
And inverts the digital divide. Digital becomes cheap, physical skills premium.
The implication runs deeper, a future where Jeffersonian natural aristocracy, those with inherent talent and agency, become highly valued. Those with the ability to articulate needs and verify outputs.
The ultimate bottleneck is verification.
Something to flag here, AI can synthesize existing knowledge rapidly, but verifying novel outputs requires existing expertise. Srinivasan compares it to the continued need for listing on premier cryptocurrency exchanges.
So AI isn't a job replacer, it's a tool that elevates individuals to a CEO role. Shifting the skill set from execution to instruction and verification.
Correct.
And that allows individuals with limited resources globally to participate more fully in the economy. He frames AI as iteration, Claude replacing ChatGPT, Midjourney replacing DALL-E Stable Diffusion, suggesting a strategic approach to organizational efficiency through continuous upgrades.
Okay, let's make a prediction. Given all of this and the focus on coding agents driving Anthropic's growth, we'll revisit this on July 8th. But I bet Anthropic acquires at least 3 significant DevOps tooling companies before then.
I agree.
And I'll add a rider. The acquisitions will be specifically focused on companies with strong security protocols and a demonstrable track record of vulnerability management.
July 8th it is.
But this entire shift from hype to utility, from expansion to verification, makes one thing clear. We're entering an era where trust will be the most valuable commodity, and that will have massive implications for everything from macroeconomic stability to geopolitical leverage.
Jet fuel prices aren't coming down even after the war ends. That's optimistic. We're talking about deglobalization and stagflationary pressures today, right?
Consider this, the sustained high cost of international travel, particularly to Europe and Asia, is a symptom of a much larger recalibration. It's not a temporary spike, it's a new price floor embedded in a fractured supply chain. We're seeing echoes of the 1960s guns and butter dynamic, as Richard Bernstein pointed out, where increased defense spending alongside fiscal spending creates inflationary pressure.
Guns and butter, but with semiconductors instead of steel.
A fair analogy. The key difference, and what makes this particularly concerning, is the sludgy labor market. While the Fed is acting more aggressively than in the 60s, the anticipation of reduced opportunities fueled by tech advancements is creating a self-fulfilling slowdown. It's a 1970s vibe, Bernstein argues, where both employers and employees see a shrinking pie, even with strong headline numbers.
Even if the numbers say everything is fine, people are prepping for bad times. That's productive.
There's a signal here that disconnect is critical. Jacob Shapiro's analysis of the Strait of Hormuz and the broader geopolitical landscape reinforces this. The Russia-Ukraine war isn't causing deglobalization, it's accelerating existing trends. We're witnessing physical cracks in supply chains, fertilizers, LNG, mid-tier petrochemicals, and emerging markets are disproportionately vulnerable.
Mid-tier petrochemicals. The real crisis nobody's talking about.
Two things stand out. The vulnerability isn't about headline energy prices, it's about the boring stuff, as Shapiro noted, like plastics, where prices are already doubling. This isn't a demand issue, it's a structural one. And China is strategically positioning itself to benefit.
Pragmatic partner. That's a polite way of saying they're happy to scoop up Russia's resources.
It's more than that. China is attracting countries seeking alternatives to Western alliances. The Philippines renewing energy talks with China, despite being a U.S. treaty ally, is a prime example. It's a recalibration of geopolitical priorities driven by energy security, as Shapiro highlights, a calculation rooted in observing the U.S.'s instability in the Middle East.
The biggest geopolitical story of the year wasn't Trump's announcements, it was Mark Carney taking down the Open for Business sign at Davos.
That's a remarkably concise way to put it. Carney's action signals a shift in investor confidence, a recognition that the old assumptions about free trade are no longer valid. And Shapiro's point about the U.S. falsely assuming shale revolution insulates it from global supply chain disruptions is particularly alarming.
Alarming as in, domestic political pressures could lead to miscalculations alarming.
The implication runs deeper. The same responses to rising gas prices in 2022 are likely to resurface, driven by low approval ratings, as Shapiro observed. He's predicting shortages in key materials within a 2 to 3 week window if the Strait of Hormuz situation remains unresolved, and even sober optimists agree that May 1st is a critical date.
May 1st? That's specific.
He's tracking concrete indicators, ship traffic, jet fuel prices in Singapore, market physical price discrepancies, not just political pronouncements. And it's not about Iran wanting regime change, as Shapiro reframes it. It's about establishing chaos and obliteration of a rival, willing to accept substantial economic consequences.
Existential security concerns. I guess economic goals become secondary when you think someone's trying to destroy you.
Stepping back, the most plausible scenario, according to Shapiro, isn't restoring unimpeded shipping, but establishing a localized tolling system, even if managed by Iran. That would restore a degree of certainty, because Washington can no longer guarantee maritime stability. That fundamentally shifts away from U.S.-led globalization.
A toll booth run by Iran. It's almost efficient.
It's a pragmatic outcome, and it highlights the acceleration of deglobalization, multipolarity, and the securitization of essential resources. Investors should position themselves for these longer-term shifts, focusing on countries that can secure stable energy and technology supplies. The 1890s analogy, a period of shifting power dynamics and generational technological change, is apt. Innovation is key.
2030, 2035, cheaper energy, even with everything going on in the Strait of Hormuz. Honestly, that feels like the most absurd thing we've discussed today, and also potentially the most important. The biggest implication. Emerging markets, lacking strategic reserves, are fundamentally the most exposed. They're about to get squeezed, and the market isn't remotely prepared.
Agreed.
And that structural vulnerability in supply chains, particularly in those unglamorous mid-tier petrochemicals, is precisely where the next wave of fragility will manifest.
Which brings us to crypto's evolving role. Given that institutional investors are likely seeking alternatives to traditional supply chains and potentially increasingly unpredictable geopolitics. The idea that institutional money is fixing crypto feels optimistic, given we're still dealing with hacks that basically involve nation-states pulling the strings. Is anyone actually building security faster than geopolitical actors move?
It's a fair point. The influx of traditional finance demands robust controls, as Chris Perkins emphasized, but the Drift hack vividly illustrates the asymmetry of the threat landscape. The speed of on-chain transactions is inherently at odds with the latency of legal processes, and the 75,000 existing tokens create an incredibly broad attack surface.
75,000. That's a lot of wrappers with varying amounts of actual substance. Austin Campbell equated it to ETFs. It's about what's inside, not the sheer number. Franklin Templeton acquiring 250 digital isn't just about access, it's about institutionalizing the vetting process, right?
Worth noting Franklin Templeton's history with tokenization, Jenny Johnson's longstanding commitment, and their tokenized money market fund are strategic foundational pieces. They're effectively building regulated pathways for traditional financial activity on-chain, bypassing the need for purely DeFi solutions, think M&A transactions using stablecoin-like assets.
Which is frankly wild. We're talking about bypassing decades of financial infrastructure with smart contracts. But that reliance on centralized stablecoins is also a massive point of failure. Circle's response, or lack thereof, to Drift is infuriating.
It highlights a core tension Amanda Wick noted. Circle prioritizes minimal legal risk over proactive user fund protection, even when evidence suggests immediate action is warranted. Tether operates with a more pragmatic, risk-based approach. That slow response also gives North Korea a clear operating window, as they actively prefer USDC for its liquidity.
North Korea? Seriously? They're running a crypto war machine. I'm half expecting a Booth Babe at the next conference to be a deep cover operative. Honestly, it's unbelievable.
The sophistication of these attacks, as Laura Shin detailed, is the disturbing part. It's no longer just finding code exploits, it's about six-month intelligence operations building trust with engineering teams. That operational security failure is now the primary driver of these hacks, surpassing smart contract vulnerabilities.
Okay, so what's the solution? Nation-state attacks are beyond individual companies. Austin Campbell's neo-privateers, regulated citizens licensed to recover assets, sounds straight out of a spy novel.
It addresses the latency issue, the gap between on-chain speed and legal norms. He anticipates customizable vault-based solutions powered by AI to meet specific client needs, a shift toward personalized portfolio management. But ultimately, the current macro environment offers a buyer's market for tokens with durable revenue, according to Ram Ahluwalia, so thorough research is paramount.
A buyer's market built on the back of geopolitical risk and questionable security practices. This isn't exactly a reassuring pitch. If institutional investors need Franklin Templeton to hold their hands, what happens when the next Drift comes along? We'll be watching Circle's actions very closely, particularly if they establish a reciprocal duty of care given the reliance DeFi places on USDC. So wrapping up today, it feels like we've been dissecting different facets of the same fundamental shift. We started with energy markets and geopolitical pressure points, moved into the enterprise realities of AI, then looked at macroeconomic cracks and crypto's institutional turn. The 800 ships caught in the Persian Gulf, Anthropic's growth, Franklin Templeton's acquisition spree, these aren't isolated events, are they? They feel like symptoms of a system reconfiguring.
There's a signal here. What's emerging is a landscape defined by a pervasive erosion of trust. Trust in stable supply chains, trust in easily scalable technological solutions, and frankly, trust in conventional economic indicators. The pricing and relief, not reality, dynamic we discussed regarding energy feels applicable across the board. We're seeing a disconnect between surface-level optimism, like a 16% drop in Brent crude, and the deeply embedded infrastructural vulnerabilities, like Hungary holding $90 billion in EU loans.
And it's not just vulnerabilities. It's the normalization of pressure. Daniel Bimon's TACO framework, threats, announcement, compliance, off-ramp, feels like a manual for the new international order. Economic leverage is being deployed with increasing frequency, and that ripples through everything. That extends to crypto, where institutional interest demands control, clashing with the original promise of decentralization.
The pattern is clear. That brings us to the underlying engine of all this, a deglobalization trend fueled by geopolitical realignment and fiscal strain. The cost of verification of securing even a single line of code, as Project Glasswing illustrates, is skyrocketing. We're effectively building a world where guns and butter are being replaced by security and verification. It's not simply a case of a buyer's market in crypto, as Ram Ahluwalia pointed out, it's that the price of due diligence is becoming prohibitive for anyone unwilling to do the work.
So where does this lead? Anthropic acquiring DevOps companies isn't just interesting, it's a signal that security infrastructure is the next battlefield and they're consolidating control. May 1st feels like a critical inflection point for the Strait of Hormuz, but I suspect the underlying fragility will persist, regardless of any immediate resolution.
I agree. And I think we'll see the jet fuel price floor become increasingly entrenched. Looking at the bigger picture, this feels like a long, slow recalibration, a dismantling of interconnectedness and a painful rebuilding focused on resilience. The question isn't whether there will be disruptions, we're already experiencing them, it's how we adapt, how we build trust in a world where it's increasingly scarce. It's like painstakingly charting a new Silk Road, acutely aware that every single stone laid could compromise the entire endeavor.
That's unsettling to say the least. And frankly, a little unnerving. Thanks for joining us today as we navigate this complexity.
My pleasure, Maya. It's a conversation we'll continue to have undoubtedly tomorrow.
And we'll be back then, keeping an eye on these shifting sands.